Good day and welcome to Ascend Radio, our podcast on everything related to regulation, licensing, GovTech, and public policy. I'm your host, Paul Levoy, and I'm responsible for content here at Ventia and Ascend Magazine, where we offer you all the latest news, insight, and analysis on everything related to regulation and licensing. On this podcast, we interview a whole range of experts from the world of regulation for their thoughts, ideas, and opinions on a range of topics related to regulation. Now, the acceleration of new technology over the last decade has given regulators, like many other industries, access to more data than ever before. We've seen machine learning revolutionized sectors from law to healthcare to education, but regulation has been comparatively slow to follow. So how can regulators embrace AI to improve their regulatory decision-making? And what should the future of AI and regulation look like? To explore these questions, I'm thrilled to welcome Anna Vandergaag, Professor of Ethics and Regulation at the University of Surrey. Excitingly, Anna is leading a team working with nursing regulators in the US and the UK to develop a tool to support regulatory decision-making. Now, Vandergaag's resume is pretty extensive, but just to give some background highlights here, she holds regulatory roles in the health, social care, and legal sectors, and has a particular interest in how regulators can be proactive in the prevention of harm. Harm in the prevention of are terms that you'll hear quite a few times throughout our conversation, as it's very central to her mandate. Anna is also visiting professor in ethics and religion at the University of Surrey, as I mentioned. She's former chair of the Health and Care Professions Council. In 2019, she was appointed chair of the Responsible Gaming Strategy Board. She's received an honorary degree from Birmingham City University. She was awarded a CBE, or Commander of the British Empire, in 2015 for her services to health and care. She's a founding member of the Q Community, which is a quality improvement network led by the Health Foundation. And she has a very strong research background, and she contributes to research in regulation internationally as well as in the UK. Now, I should note that Anna and I recorded our conversation in the final months of 2021 before the arrival of the Omicron variant and in the midst of the ever-changing beast called coronavirus. So that's something to keep in mind for a conversation which inevitably touches on COVID-19 and its various effects. But without further ado, here's our conversation on AI regulation, as well as Vandergaag's exciting work on a decision port tool for regulators. Can you tell me a little bit about your current role?
So I've actually got sort of multiple current roles. So as you said, I'm a visiting professor at the University of Surrey, and my research work I undertake in that context. But I'm also chair of the advisory board for Safer Gambling. So I'm involved in gambling regulation and particularly looking at harm reduction in relation to gambling activities. And I'm also a non-executive on a mental health trust in the UK. So those two roles clearly overlap. But I think my role in the regulatory environment, I've just finished a project with colleagues looking at how or whether we can develop decision support tools for use in disciplinary processes. And it's been very exciting. We've been working with three jurisdictions. We've been working in the US, in Texas, in the UK, in London, and in Australia, in Melbourne. So really excited by that piece of work. It's been funded by NCSBN, the national regulator for nurses in the US, who gave us a grant to develop this prototype. And we've just finished that. In fact, it's about to be published in their Journal of Nurse Regulation.
Can I ask why those regions in particular? Is there anything that ties them together, or was it more of an opportunity-based thing?
Well, I think it was partly opportunity-based. Certainly in the UK, I knew the regulator very well, the nursing regulator very well. And similarly in Australia, I knew the APRA team who eventually collaborated with us. In fact, in Texas, I didn't know the individuals at all, but they showed an interest in the project. I think they have a track record in innovation in regulation and health regulation, so we were delighted to work with them also. So it was really interesting across all those different time zones. We managed to work together very effectively.
What do you hope comes out of this project?
One of the things that I became aware of from previous work was that certainly in health regulation, I don't know how much this applies in other regulatory worlds, the actual number of complaints that are upheld about health practitioners is relatively small. So if you look at the UK figures, it's around about, for doctors, it's around about 72% of cases that go nowhere. There's no case to answer. It's around about 68% for nurses and around about the same for physios and occupational therapists and others. So there's a high proportion that actually are of individuals who are complained about, who are then investigated, but then there's no complaint upheld. So I was interested in looking at whether the complaints process itself was fit for purpose and whether having a one-size-fits-all investigation of complaints actually was the right way to deal with complaints. Because, of course, complaints handling in any context is very costly. It takes a long time. It's very labour intensive. And I suppose what we began to think about in the early stages of this project was whether technology could be applied to decision making in order to, you know, reduce costs, but also, more importantly, to improve quality and consistency, and, you know, really unleash the power of data. And that, I think, is what technology can do in regulation. We see it happening in all sorts of areas of our lives. I think we felt there was a real opportunity to test this out in a regulatory environment. And that's where we began.
Can you give me an example? I mean, I can wrap my head around it conceptually, but can you give me an example of, you know, the methodology in action, how you might actually like test or you know, evaluate the potential of these sorts of tools at use in regulation?
Yeah. So what, if you can imagine, if you think about the way a complaint comes into a regulatory body, and it's then assessed against criteria. So it's assessed against the standards of the regulator. The case manager will probably look a little bit at the context of the case. We'll look at the risks and make a judgment about the risk of further harm or whether or not that case needs to be expedited because there's significant risk of harm. So they'll make a judgment about whether there is a case to answer or they think there's a case to answer. They'll make a judgment about the risks involved and they'll look at the context. And really what the decision support tool that we've developed is doing is effectively replicating that but using a much larger data set to reach those judgments about risk, about context, about similarity with other cases. The algorithm allows the humans involved in the process to effectively kind of quality assure their own decision. So we're not taking human judgment out, but we are certainly adding something into the decision-making process, which we think adds a layer of quality, of consistency, of robustness to the process. Because if you think about it, what you're doing in these decision support tools is you're actually accessing a far larger data set than the one that the case manager has access to in their either on their desktop or in their head. They may be very experienced and they may be able to make those judgments quickly using their prior experience, but compared to what a machine learning tool can access, it's a tiny amount of data. And that's the thing that we're trying to sort of to bring in to this particular regulatory function. And I think based on the work that we've done, we've been working with nearly 6,000 cases across the three jurisdictions. So that's a pretty big data set for a health regulatory project. We think this has potential for other areas of regulation, like registration, accreditation, as well as the disciplinary enforcement side as well.
Have you ever seen, are there any other examples you can think of these large data sets being used for, informed decision making and analysis?
Well, so I think in healthcare, that there's an enormous amount going on in healthcare. I mean, the use of algorithms in early cancer diagnosis, for example, in radiological investigations of various kinds. I think in law, there's some, really successful use of these sorts of decision support tools in the classification of cases. And in even in areas like human resources, the kind of detecting harassment in emails, for example, algorithms are being used there. But I think there's not much at the moment in health regulation or regulation more generally. I don't know. There may be others who have experience of it in other regulatory environments, but certainly in health regulation, I know of only one example in Australia where algorithms have been used to assess risk factors in looking at healthcare professionals. So, risk factors like age, risk factors like levels of isolation in people's practice. So if they're sole practitioners working in rural environments, they tend to be, they've been found to be higher risk than those who are working in managed environments within teams. So I think it's been used in those sorts of contexts, but to my knowledge, it hasn't been used in the disciplinary work in the way that we've been using it in this project.
Right. Back in 2013, in my research, I found that you spoke about compassion and creativity in health and social care at the launch of the University of London's new Masters of Health and Social Care programs. And there you talked about the revolution you believe needed to be happening in health and social care. So I have two questions there. What was that revolution you were looking for? And that was 8 years ago now. Has it happened? Would be my second question.
Gosh, that's really digging into the past. I think for me, the most significant revolution in health and social care has been the active involvement of people with lived experience, their patients, their families, active involvement of the people who receive care in decision-making about their own care, but also about the design of healthcare delivery itself. So I believe passionately in equality there, that we must have more people with lived experience involved in decision making at every level. So that for me is the sort of the key revolution in health and social care that I think all systems would benefit from. Because if you can see healthcare delivery from the perspective of those who receive it, you're almost bound to improve it. Whereas if you only see it from the perspective of the professional, you will have blind spots. You won't see things that they can see. So involvement and equality, I think, for me, are absolutely fundamental to the revolution. I think more recently, and this may be related, I think that in the current context, we're living in a pandemic. We're living through a pandemic. We don't know what's the other side of that. And I think the revolution in regulation is that it needs to ask itself about its own relevance in that new world, in that new post-pandemic world, and whether we can continue to keep people safe and to maintain high professional standards, but reduce the bureaucratic burden that is regulation. I think I hear more and more, I see more and more, perhaps more, even certainly more than I saw in 2013, I see more burden on practitioners, on organisations, on hospitals, on institutions. The burden of bureaucracy, I think, in many jurisdictions has reached a tipping point. I think it needs a revolution. And for me, technology is one of the tools, the most effective tools in that revolution. That, to unleash the power of data, to make data collection and data analysis much more accessible, much easier, much less time consuming, is a hugely important part of the new world that we do need to create. We're incredibly aware of the impact that this pandemic has had on the professionals at the front line. I watched a really powerful documentary that was made by Kevin MacDonald called The Story of Us, which you can find on YouTube, which was about the impact of the pandemic on the health workforce. And, the stories of doctors making choices in ICUs about which patients were given ventilators because there weren't enough to go round. And I think what we see now is a growing awareness of the huge psychological toll on healthcare practitioners themselves. And I think if health regulation, can be mindful of that and think about the impact, of regulation on those who are regulated, then I see that as a real way out of what we are currently in, which is, I think, is a workforce crisis in healthcare. We're losing good people because the circumstances in which they're working are just so burdensome. So my question to regulators is, how can we reduce that burden? What can we do that's innovative and, revolutionary, in my terms, to change that model so that it's more fit for purpose for the 21st century?
Right. And proactive and preventive, I presume. You've long had a focus on looking at how regulators can be proactive in the prevention of harm. So what are some of the greatest opportunities for regulators to have an impact in this regard?
So I think, if we think about what regulators around the globe do, they set standards, they keep registers, they discipline, they educate they accredit. And those are all really important functions, and they are about maintaining standards, delivering high quality services, protecting the public from harm. I think there's been change in recent years, and this is very much in the proactive prevention arena, is that regulators have become much more interested in understanding the context in which harm arises. So rather than just looking at the individual characteristics or the individual failures, we're now beginning to see that many failures arise from professional isolation, disengagement, poor support, poor leadership, poor management. And those contextual aspects have probably not been given enough attention and enough focus in the past. And I think now we realise that if we are going to be proactive in the prevention of harm, then understanding the context is absolutely critical to that. The second thing, and this is, I think, one that's perhaps less talked about, is regulators have data that no one else has. And so my kind of challenge, I suppose, is to see if we can find better ways of sharing data. Now, there are all sorts of challenges around sharing data, which are rightly there and to do with confidentiality and protecting people's identity and so on. But the fact that regulators have data that no one else has means that they potentially can use that data more effectively to identify, for example, pockets of poor practice or perhaps areas where there are recurring themes that are in the data, but not necessarily known to the people who are on the ground in that particular institution or organisation. So understanding data, sharing data, and using data more proactively, I think, will help us in the prevention of harm.
A strong focus on your recent work has also involved looking at ways to promote professionalism in the healthcare workforce and to explore, I believe, as I read it put somewhere, what makes or breaks good care. So to that end, what makes or breaks good care?
What makes or breaks good care? Mm-hmm. I think this is absolutely at the heart of good professional practice. If we could find those and identify those in every situation where things go wrong, we would be well on the way to prevention of harm. So I think what makes good care is a combination of good education, knowledge, skills, understanding, and the right values, the values that are appropriate to the context. So I would count values of respect, of compassion, of understanding and seeing the world through somebody else's eyes rather than just through your own lens. So I think that the combination of education maintained throughout our entire working lives, self-reflection, and an understanding of where somebody else is coming from are hugely important to good care. It's not just about technical competence. And actually, when you look at the complaints data about doctors or nurses or other healthcare professionals, the vast majority of complaints are not about technical competence. They are about communication failures. They are about lack of respect. They are about a failure to care with compassion and dignity. So I think what breaks good care is often not what's in the individual. It can be in rare instances. It can be about the individual. It can be about a deliberate desire to harm. But in the majority of cases, I think it's about the context and the support that that person has to do their job well. It's the resources within that institution or that context. It's the management support. It's the peer support. It's the freedom to be reflective and to have time to think about your practice. Those are the things that really are broken in our systems. It's not the individuals, it's not the individual practitioners by and large. It's the systems around them that break good care.
Right. So I was going to ask next what, where healthcare regulation is deficient currently. And I suppose from what I've gathered so far, there's great opportunities in technology on the one side of things. And then there's great opportunities in how we can, I guess, pivot on soft skills broadly to embed things like compassion into the whole process. Sounds like a really tall order. How do you institutionalize, how do you make a system compassionate?
I think you're absolutely right. And in a sense, we're talking about two ends of a continuum, aren't we? We're talking about the technology end and a revolution in unleashing the power of data, using data more effectively on a day-to-day basis. And at the other end, we're talking about incredibly difficult to measure things like compassion, like respect, like and also self-awareness and the ability to look at oneself and try and change through that process of self-reflection. Those are incredibly opposite ends of the continuum. But I do think that the challenge for regulation is that we address both of those ends, and there's probably lots in between them, and there's lots of overlap. So if I give you a very practical example, when we started working with the nursing regulator in the UK, and we started talking and exploring with them how these decision support tools might work. There were a couple of moments when the case managers, so these are the unsung heroes of regulation, the people who are doing the work day to day, making those decisions about cases and whether a case should be progressed on a day to day basis. And there were a couple of moments when there was an exclamation of delight that somebody had come up with something that would support them in their work. So for me, that was a moment when those two ends of the continuum came together, and actually to have compassion and care for the very people that we rely on in regulation to make the day-to-day decisions, to recognize that they're doing an incredibly difficult job, stressful job, dealing with complaints day in, day out, and the introduction of new technical solutions that would help them to do their job more quickly, with less cost, and we hope with greater consistency in the decision-making process. So that for me was a great example of the two ends of the continuum that I care greatly and deeply about coming together, that we were going to make people's lives better in their day-to-day work. We were also going to make the process of regulatory decision-making more robust. And I guess everybody who is involved in technical innovation right now in healthcare or any other sector, that's what they want. They want to see people's lives transformed, people's lives made easier, people's lives made less burdensome, And technology has that within it if we design it right and we design it with the people who are going to be using the technology on a day-to-day basis.
Right. It sounds like there's a great, technology-enabled future in this, a promised land where these elements come together. But in terms of if a regulator were thinking in terms of today, what are some of the ways that I can, as a healthcare regulator, mitigate harm, prevent harm currently? Can you think of any more lower hanging fruit, any more actionable things that they can do?
Yeah, so and that's a really good question because so much of this is about resources. And for many regulators, those additional resources are not available to them at the moment. So I think there are three things. I think know your data. So I think, even with a limited amount of technology, you can still invest time in knowing your data, looking at trends, looking at patterns, looking at where complaints are coming from. So know your data. The second is work collaboratively with other regulators and other agencies within your ecosystem. So you're sharing information, not disclosing confidential information, but sharing information on trends. And I think that leads to the third mitigation, which is by identifying, hotspots of, say, whether a cluster of concerns coming from a particular hospital or a very high number of complaints being received from a particular employer, that you identify those and you work with those individuals at a local level. So I think one of the real challenges that regulators have is, traditionally regulators are quite remote from what's happening on the ground. And I think one of the ways that we can mitigate harm is to use the data that is at the disposal of the regulator proactively in engaging at the local level. So use that macro level data to identify micro level trends, harms, patterns, and then have those conversations about what could be done to prevent harm arising in the first place.
In terms of that, data enabled future that's before us, do you see any functional examples of AI, of machine learning in regulation within or outside of healthcare currently? And be that in the UK or, in North America, Australia, wherever. Are we seeing any encouraging early signs of that in action?
Well, I think, as I said earlier, I think from our scan of health regulation, and that may be limited, it's certainly limited to certain jurisdictions, but we haven't seen any day-to-day use of these sorts of decision support tools in disciplinary processes. As I've said, I think Marie Bismarck in Australia has done some really innovative work on risk, assessing risk factors in the health professions, using these sorts of tools. But I think we're at the very early stages of this work. I mean, I'm very encouraged that the three regulators that we worked with are all keen to develop the prototype, because it is a prototype at the moment. Their intention is for the tool to be embedded in business as usual operations. So that would be fantastic for us as researchers to see that come to pass. I think it's very exciting that they are excited, that they can see the potential And we have shared all our learning with them. It's very much been a co-production with those three regulatory bodies. And, you know, my hope, as I say, is that we see them taking this work forward and sharing it with other regulators, replicating it, sharing it. I am in no doubt that the next 10 years we're going to see more of this kind of innovation. You know, with the caveat that I'm very aware that for some regulators, you know, resourcing it will be a challenge.
Speaking of 10 years, so in 10 years, flash forward, how would you like to be able to, you know, in 2031, how would you like to be able to describe our collective approaches to regulation then as opposed to today?
Gosh, it's always dangerous, isn't it, to think about what life is going to be like in 10 years' time. I think I would say, firstly, I'm sure you picked that up. I am so excited about the work that we've just finished, or, you know, we finished, but others are going to take forward. I think so the first thing would be more technology embedded in regulatory decision making. More technology embedded in regulatory decision making. Absolutely. That is part of the future. But not at the expense of fairness, transparency, and a recognition of the human factors. So I would like to see a regulatory world more data driven, more risk sensitive, more technology friendly, you know, more proactive in prevention of harm. But I also would like to see regulation kinder.
I get the, you know, impression from the work that you're doing, across continents, that things are in motion in terms of technology. But like, what are some of the barriers for us? Seems like we have everything we need to be able to put this in motion, to actualize it. What are the barriers to using tech and regulation, say, like tomorrow or even yesterday for that matter? What is stopping us?
So I think one of the very practical things that's stopping us at the moment is that we need, within regulatory bodies, you know, we need to employ data scientists. We need to employ people with the skill set that, you know, some of the people on my team have. You know, they're very, very experienced in developing this sort of technology. We need to have people who have that training actually employed in regulatory bodies. I think that building that capacity and capability in-house, as well as, you know, accessing expertise and tools from elsewhere, is going to be really important. But I think that's a barrier at the moment, is that the actual skill set that we have needs to change, and that's always challenging for any organization. So data scientists, I suppose a strategic shift towards technology, which means channeling more resources into the development of new technologies. And I suppose if that shift comes, then I think that it has to run alongside engagement with stakeholders on why this is important and why this is beneficial and why in the long term this is going to be good for everybody. So I think we haven't had that debate yet in regulation. And you know, for all sorts of very good reasons, people are suspicious of these new technologies. You know, they see them as intrusive, they see them as inaccessible, they see them as potentially risky in terms of protecting people's identity. So I think there are all kinds of ethical barriers, if you like, to the introduction of new technologies. But, you know, as I say, that debate needs to be had, because I don't think we can sit by and say this technology is not for us. It's everywhere. It's about how it's used and the governance around it, and the transparency that's built in to the tool itself. I mean, we were very keen in our work to allow those who were working in the three jurisdictions to really understand how the machine was making decisions and how that related to the decisions that were made by humans. And there are different types of algorithms, and I'm certainly not a technical person, as you probably gather, but you know, there are different kinds of decision support tools. Some are more transparent than others. And so I would be certainly saying it's important for regulators to make those as transparent as is possible. So capability, resources, strategic commitment, and engagement, I think, are where I think we need to see some collective action. And you can't introduce anything without talking about it and debating it and hearing the voices of those who object. You need to be there in the room listening and explaining what you're trying to do.
You know, the ongoing global pandemic has come up a couple of times in our chat so far. What are some of the practical takeaways you found, you know, through your lens and in your field from the past year and a half, give or take, that we've been living through? If, for example, you know, we get over this and then we're hit by another pandemic, heaven forbid, in a couple of years, you know, what lessons learned would you say, okay, we've got to do X, Y, and Z? What insights have you gleaned?
So I always have front of mind when I think about this, the wonderful Don Berwick, who I'm sure you know, one of the great thinkers behind quality improvement methodologies initially in the US, but throughout the world. And he talked about the heavy fog of worry that hangs over us in this pandemic. And I remember hearing him say that at the very, very start. I think that heavy fog of worry still hangs over us. I think there are some obvious things that we can point to, like, you know, the incredible acceleration in the use of technology and remote work, you know, remote ways of working that are enabled by technology, and the potential of reaching more people, you know, whether that's in healthcare or, you know, any other transaction. It's incredible how we've moved on in this pandemic, and that's a huge positive, and it will change our working lives and our personal lives forever, in really significant ways. I mean, I think I talked a little bit about earlier about the recognition, I think, the public recognition of the impact that this pandemic has had on frontline healthcare workers, the huge psychological toll, physical toll, emotional toll on healthcare staff and their families, and that you know, for health regulators to be mindful of this in their engagement, you know, that regulated individuals mostly do the very best that they can do for patients and their families, and I think what the pandemic has done has brought that into very sharp relief, that if we ever forgot just how important the healthcare workforce is to all our societies, wherever we live and work, then the pandemic has reminded us of that. I think beyond that, I think that the incredible acceleration in vaccine development has just been astonishing. And so I think the fact that we now celebrate our scientists in ways that we didn't before is really, really positive. And that we also probably have a greater understanding, at some level anyway, of science and the importance of evidence, together with, you know, a collective embrace of technology. The thing that I think is less talked about is that for many people, that, you know, they don't have access to the internet. So there are excluded communities all over the world who haven't benefited from this new, you know, way of interacting. And I think we must ensure that we don't forget those who don't have access. I think the pandemic has highlighted the huge inequalities that exist within our societies and between our societies, and I hope has prompted governments to think more about what can be done, you know, at the national level as well as at the local level to address those inequalities. And I do think regulators need to be at the table in those discussions, particularly around access to education and ongoing learning. It's very unequal at the moment, and I think that needs to be addressed. But, you know, that heavy fog of worry, I think, sits over all of us still. And we don't quite know what the future holds and how we're going to come out of this. I do think there's more emphasis on kindness and the importance of kindness and compassion. And that narrative runs through, you know, many organisations now in a way that it didn't in the past. So I think that's really, really another positive that we can celebrate and do whatever we can to enhance it in our own context.
You've alluded in our chat to, I think, an Australian jurisdiction that's sort of leading the curve in terms of technology. More broadly, in terms of technology and on the softer side of things, you know, to leading with compassion. Are there any, you know, jurisdictions around the world, UK, Canada, US, Australia, wherever, that you kind of fancy as shining examples of progressive, you know, just really, really, really a great ideal examples of end-to-end regulation in healthcare?
So, I mean, I certainly would point to NCSBN. I think they've done a fantastic amount of work in bringing debate about the use of technology to the fore. I think they've also done a huge amount to bring debate about how we collaborate across jurisdictions in nursing regulation, for example, sharing data, working more collaboratively. So I think they are a really good example of, you know, really embracing the challenges of technology. I think that those who are recognizing that current systems are unsustainable. So we know from research that, you know, there's been an exponential growth in the number of complaints about healthcare practitioners, for example. But as I said earlier, an awful lot of those complaints, you know, 70-80% of those complaints are not upheld. So that's a huge number that go nowhere, but still require a huge amount of regulatory resource So I think in that area, the current system is unsustainable. We can't go on just dealing with complaints in exactly the same way. We have to change. And I think NCSBN is leading that charge. I'm delighted that Texas is one of the regulators that we've been working with. They are absolutely leading in the US, as are the Australian health regulator and the Nursing and Midwifery Council in the UK. Really embrace this agenda and recognizing that the status quo is no longer, we can't sustain things we can't run processes in the same way. But I think for me, the shining, the examples of progressive, beyond that, I keep coming back to, the goal is to be people centric, but with technical know-how, to create faster, fairer and more flexible regulation. That's the goal. And I think there are many regulators around the world who are trying to do that in many different ways. And I think that's very exciting.
We're coming to the end of our time here, but the multiple roles that you have right now, and work that you've done on standardized communication assessments and studies of professional competence, and work in quality improvement initiatives for health professionals. Above and beyond what we talked about, so I guess principally technology, COVID-19, and whatnot. What's really top of mind for you these days? You have your fingers in many pies in this world. What else is keeping you up at night, as it were?
So I think in the current context, the burden of regulation and how we continue to keep people safe through high standards, whilst really tackling the regulatory and bureaucratic burden that we place on people. And I think technology can help, but I think we need boldness in our vision of what we can change. And I think we're, regulation is naturally a cautious industry, and rightly so, because it is about protecting people, and change happens slowly. But I think boldness is on my mind right now. I think where we are now demands it. So to make some courageous decisions at a strategic level about where we are going and where we want to be, that will require courage.
Boldness, I suppose that flows from good leadership, right?
Indeed. And I think in a sense, you point out the kind of interconnectedness between the different roles I have. And I think, my role in the mental health sector, just shows me on a daily basis, the struggles that people have and the struggles that have emerged as a result of this pandemic. And we can't be separate from that as in the regulatory world. I think in a sense, one of the benefits, I suppose, if there is a benefit of all of this, is that we understand better about mental health and well-being. For ourselves, for our families, and for the health professionals who look after us, and mental and physical health, I think, have long been separated, and there's been much more investment and attention paid to physical health because it's visible, it's tangible, and now I think we're seeing that we need to pay attention to mental health as well. So that to me is something that is both a huge challenge for us in our various countries and jurisdictions and localities, but also a huge opportunity. And I think there will be change for good down the road.
Thanks everyone for listening. I hope you found our conversation on AI regulation and everything related to it useful. The potential for data and AI in regulation is actually quite astounding. And it's a conversation we'll be touching on an ongoing basis on Ascend Magazine. So I'd really encourage listeners to head over there if you haven't already for the resources and content and writing on these topics. And we also encourage you to submit your own ideas, whether it's for guests to pursue or topics to discuss. We have plenty of exciting podcast recordings coming up in the coming weeks. We'll be releasing our first season of content here on Ascend Magazine on a bi-weekly basis. So we encourage you to stick around. And I should also note, in addition to subscribing to our podcast, you should definitely, if you are a regulator or you work around the regulatory space, you should definitely subscribe to Week in Brief. This is our weekly, every Monday sort of rundown of the biggest topics in regulation and licensing from across the US, across Canada, and around the world. In our newsroom, we really pore over these topics on a daily basis, and we distill it down to what we think is the most relevant and important. So everything from licensing backlogs to COVID mandate responses to the labor shortages that we're experiencing coast to coast right now in many different professions. You can keep a pulse on all of it by subscribing to the Week in Brief podcast. In any event, I hope you found this information useful, and we look forward to chatting with you again.